Hello, this is episode number 30 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, September 20th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. This week we'll be talking about two copyright issues. First, Congress has been considering legislation that would extend copyright-like protections to the fashion industry. Second, in the decision of Dolan versus Gonzalez earlier this month, the Tenth Circuit held that Congress cannot reimpose copyright restrictions on public domain materials without invoking heightened First Amendment scrutiny. Our first guest is a man who's been in the thick of both controversies. Professor Chris Sprigman is professor of law at the University of Virginia. He was one of the attorneys behind the Golan case, and he wrote a widely cited paper called The Piracy Paradox, arguing against extending copyright law to the fashion industry. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Our other guest is Julian Sanchez. He's a contributing editor to Reason Magazine. He recently wrote an article for The American Magazine on the congressional effort to impose copyright restrictions on the fashion industry. Hello again, Julian.
Good day, Adam.
And also we're joined, as always, by my blogging colleague, Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
Professor Sprigman, let's start with you. What did the Tenth Circuit say in the Golan decision, and what might its broader implications be for copyright law?
Well, the important part of the Golan decision is a determination by the Tenth Circuit that when Congress makes copyright laws, and in doing so really changes the way we run our copyright system in a significant way, Congress has to pay attention to the effects of those big changes to copyright on speech. So what the Tenth Circuit formally held is that in passing a piece of legislation called the Uruguay Round Agreements Act, and in that legislation, in taking thousands and thousands of works out of the public domain and sticking them back under copyright, works like Peter and the Wolf, works like Shostakovich's symphonies, many well-known movies, books, etc., that Congress had restricted very significantly what people could do with these works. The plaintiffs in the Golan case were a number of conductors, orchestra conductors, and also some movie distributors who had performed and distributed these public domain works before. Of course, when Congress recopyrighted them, they lost the ability to do that without getting permission and paying money, sometimes quite a lot of money. And what Congress said is, in doing this, what the court said is that Congress has to think about the burdens on speech, and they have to be justified under the First Amendment. So this is a big change, we hope, in the way copyright law is thought about. Copyright law, we hope, is no longer a First Amendment free zone. The way it regulates speech is going to have to be something that Congress thinks about.
Now, the case turns really on the phrase of, quote, traditional contours of copyright protection from the Supreme Court's 2003 Eldred decision.
That's
what
right.
Did that phrase really mean, and why is it so important to this particular case?
Well, so in Eldred, the Supreme Court was dealing with a law, the Copyright Term Extension Act, by which Congress extended by 20 years the terms of both future and also already existing copyrights. And there was a challenge to that copyright term extension as it applied to copyrights already in existence, right? And the challenge was pretty commonsensical. Look, you know, copyright's supposed to be about incentivizing people to create. These works have been created. There's no point in kind of re-incentivizing people. It's a quid pro nihilo, right? It's something for nothing. And, you know, this creates significant speech problems because, again, these works, which would have become free for others to use, to distribute, to comment on, to use as the basis for derivative work, these works are now locked up for another 20 years. The court said, well, look, all the way back to the beginning of copyright, Congress has been extending the terms of copyright, and every time it extends the term prospectively, it also extends the term retrospectively. So they didn't break with our history in doing it, you know, this time. They're really doing what our history shows they've always done. And so where Congress doesn't shift the traditional contours of copyright protection, the court said, well, generally the First Amendment isn't really implicated by what they do. You know, implication of that is when they do shift the contours of copyright protection, we've got to think about the First Amendment. And in the URAA, they really did shift the contours of copyright protection. They'd never done something like this before. They'd never taken you know, thousands of works out of the public domain and stuck them back under copyright.
So what would you see in an ideal world? So I, as I understand it, this was remanded to the district court to figure out exactly how the First Amendment applies. In an ideal world, what sort of First Amendment scrutiny would you like to see? Because it seems like, just on its face, copyright law always implicates speech because you're always telling certain people that they can't publish particular types of works. So what sort of distinction would you like to see that would be actually principled and could be applied in a consistent way?
Yeah, so a couple of things, Tim. First of all, I think it remains to be seen whether we're going to get back to the district court because we might go to the Supreme Court on this. So now the legitimacy of a federal statute has been called into question. Uh-huh. And typically, you know, the Justice Department, when something like this happens, asks the Supreme Court to rule. There's a case from the Ninth Circuit, Kale versus Gonzalez, that's already the subject of a cert petition in the Supreme Court. Uh-huh. So there's a circuit split right now between the Tenth Circuit, which says that the First Amendment does apply, the Ninth Circuit, which says the First Amendment doesn't. This is the kind of classic situation where a case goes to the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to determine the rule. Mm-hmm. So it's possible, you know, we could be in the Supreme Court. Assuming for the moment that we're not and we go back to the district court, the question there is going to be whether copyright is a content-neutral form of speech regulation or a content-based form of speech regulation. There are arguments on both sides. We'll see where the court comes out on that. But even if the regulation is content neutral, the government is going to have to show a good justification for what it did and that its response, its law was narrowly tailored to try to avoid the speech burden. And we think basically that the law could have been much more narrowly tailored. So, for example, in the UK and in Australia, which also took some works out of the public domain in a desire to comply with some international law obligations, they did so in a way that protects current users much better than our law does. So we think under whatever way you characterize the test here, we have a good shot. But, you know, that's – in a sense, that's – the big victory has already been won. The big victory is that the First Amendment actually has something to say, which a lot of people within the world of copyright never really thought true.
Well, let's turn the conversation now towards the other issue we wanted to discuss today, which is the fashion copyright issue. And Julian, you've been very patient. Thank you. Can you fill us in a little bit about what Congress is considering with regards to fashion copyrights?
Sure. I do want to note that while I normally cherish the writer's prerogative to work without pants, I have donned a pair of Rogan jeans just for this podcast. The proposal is one that has come up a few times in the past and always failed to be enacted, but has now actually been introduced in both the House and in the Senate this summer by Chuck Schumer and nine other co-sponsors. And the proposal is to create a limited 3-year copyright term. It's sort of analogous to a sort of sui generis copyright that has been created for boat hulls. The idea here is that it would be sort of analogous to copyrights in other works, but not last as the current ones do. I think sort of life of the author plus 70 years is the normal standard. In recognition of the seasonal nature of the fashion industry, this would be a 3-year copyright, and it would be based on the standard of substantial similarity. So the idea that any garment that is ruled to be substantially similar to a registered design, unlike other copyrights also, these would actually have to be registered. It would just be a copyright that is created when the work is fixed in a tangible medium, as with writing or music. And I think we see this happening for a couple of reasons. It's always been the case that sort of lower-end designers have imitated depending on your preferred terminology, knocked off popular fashion designs and created more affordable versions of these. And, of course, the high-end designers themselves borrow and imitate or take inspiration or, as they sometimes say, do homage to previous works. And I think it's a combination of the Internet and of technologies that allow for more flexible inventories, just-in-time inventory and flexible supply chains. Partly what's going on is that the designers are seeing that these fast fashion retailers like H&M or Zara or Forever 21 are able to have their own sort of imitation version of the runway look out in the store at the same time as, or even sometimes before, the original designer gets his stuff into the boutiques, which, you know, before they didn't really care as much if by the time the knockoff appeared, everyone who had gotten the original or was going to get the original had already sort of gotten it and moved on to a new look. Also, we're increasingly seeing these high-end designers working with mid-market retailers to create what are sometimes called mastige lines. So Target has a line called Go International. We've seen designer Vera Wang working with the Kohl's department store to create a line of more affordable clothing for them. And so in part what we're seeing is that the high-end designers are seeing that lower-end market as part of their own. It used to be the case that it just wasn't an issue because, hey, someone who was buying, you know, the H&M $40 skirt just wasn't the same customer who was in the market for the Balenciaga original.
Right.
And so they're now seeing this as a market that they want to exploit. And finally, I think we're seeing sort of a renaissance of a high-low aesthetic. And this is something that's always been around. But that you're increasingly finding that the sort of fashion tastemakers are finding it not only acceptable but even kind of, you know, cool or edgy or whatever to accent, you know, again, the $5,000 dress with, a $30 H&M jacket. And so that mix also, I think, is creating a sense among some fashion designers that, again, the knockoffs are competing in their same market, at least as they sense it, in a way that they weren't previously.
Let me ask you two quick follow-ups before I bring Professor Strigman back into this to comment mm-hmm. substantively on this. First of all, has there been a serious effort by proponents of this legislation to get a better feel for or define what substantively similar designs means or how that's interpreted? Secondly, who is going to be determining that and handing down penalties, and what are those penalties? Are those defined in this effort?
Right. Yeah, well, the easiest question first. I believe it's the penalties are the greater amount of either $250,000 or $5 per copy produced, which, as I understand it, is actually greater than the penalties normally afforded under copyright law. Although, again, I should say that even the sponsors of this law have acknowledged that there are problems in the current version of the bill. So industries, Orrin Hatch actually sort of read testimony to the congressional records of saying, we recognize there are issues with this as it stands, and this needs to be modified. So remains to be seen whether that would be the final outcome. Substantial similarity here is tricky. It would be the courts, of course, I guess, determining this by the same standard they use for things like music and film. This is trickier in fashion, I think, for a number of reasons. I mean, part of it is that I think just intuitively, deciding whether someone has made a song that just sounds like another song a little bit, or one that is really a copy, is maybe, I think, more intuitive, even though there are certainly cases in this regard where I think the courts have probably overreached, than deciding whether two striped dresses really look the same. And in fact, the courts use different standards here. Some courts have used the ordinary observer standard. So does the average Joe on the street look at these two things and say, yeah, it looks like these are pretty much the same? Or do they use the more discerning observer, the expert eye? And I think there was an amusing instance in the hearing they had when this was introduced in the House, where they showed a picture of two dresses, and you know the designer said, no, these are different. These are very different. The one has spaghetti straps, one has a cat sleeve, and the congressman all said, well, no, these look the same to me. So yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be extraordinarily tricky, given how much sort of copying and inspiration is so integral to fashion. Deciding what's
right.
substantially similar, I think, is going to be a huge sort of
right. Now, Professor Strigman, let me bring you back in here because I believe you've been critical of this idea. And let me just play devil's advocate. It's certainly going to be a devil's advocate position because I don't believe in what I'm about to say. But I mean, one could argue, hey, why is it that fashions aren't copyrighted? Why have we left these sorts of intellectual creations out of the copyright mix, if you will? Aren't they getting ripped off when there are knockoff vendors or somebody has a Gucci ripoff purse or something like that? I mean, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, the reason that we've left fashion out of the copyright law is because fashion works really great without copyright. The market in fashion is growing. Fashion firms are making money. Designers are doing well. There's tons of competition. There's tons of entry. There's lots of choice for consumers at a variety of different prices. So the entire market is thriving in the absence of copyright. And if we, I think, introduce copyright into this thriving market, we're likely to really succeed only in shooting ourselves in the foot. Now, you know, I want to just give some props to Julian. I think having read his article in The American, it really is, to my mind, the most thoughtful piece on this whole issue I've seen in the following sense. Julian really kind of looks at both sides of this issue and you know, comes up with some really good observations about, you know, what's potentially driving this latest effort to get copyright extended to fashion, and also comes up with some critical arguments about what some of the dangers are. So, you know, I would urge people to read Julian's piece. So, look, my basic point here is we've got a $200 billion or so industry in the States, right? Probably more than $1 trillion a year globally, probably quite a bit more than $1 trillion a year globally. And how does the industry work? It's worked this way forever. Designers take inspiration from one another, and they look at what their colleagues are doing, and they copy. And this doesn't mean, again, I want to say this very, very clearly, this doesn't mean that they turn out dresses and suits and accessories that look exactly like what their colleagues are doing. Sometimes that happens. But far the bigger phenomenon is that they take something that they like from a design that appears to be popular, and they use it, they work with it, they play with it, they recontextualize it, and they put their own stamp on it and offer their creation to the public. And why is this important? This is important because this is the way trends are made. Trends are made this way, and trends are, of course, incredibly important because this is how the industry really profits, right? They induce us to buy clothes, not by, you know, selling us stuff and waiting until it wears out, but selling us stuff and wearing out the trend, right, and inducing us to buy something from the next trend. So this is the basic creative dynamic of the industry. And the freedom that designers currently enjoy to take inspiration one from another is the way that this dynamic works. Now, you know, Julian said a bunch of stuff about substantial similarity, and, you know, I would join him in saying that courts have used different tests, and it's actually incredibly confusing. But I would add something to that, which is as confusing as substantial similarity is in music and in graphic arts like photography, it's going to be an order of magnitude more confusing in fashion. Because dresses that often look quite similar in part because, you know, we human beings have two arms and two legs. And, you know, a certain shape that doesn't change very much over time. And the kind of palette of possible creativity is somewhat constrained. And so, you know, a short, black, tight dress looks like another short, black, tight dress. And to say that one is an originator and one is a copy is often very difficult. And so what are you going to get? I think you're going to get a lot of uncertainty. I think if this bill goes through, which I doubt, but if it does go through, you're going to get a lot of litigation, and you're going to get this industry being burdened by the necessity of lawyers checking out pretty much everything, you know, a designer wants to do. And this is good for nobody except the lawyers.
Well, I can see it being good for maybe whoever it is who would sit in judgment of these things, not just the lawyers who get to litigate the cases, but I think it'd be kind of cool to maybe be a fashion industry copyright expert, and I get to sit in front of hot runway models who have played their dresses before me. So if I could maybe be sign up for that position, I could go for this plan.
But no, you see, I
can't find another advantage to this idea.
Yeah, I love being an academic, but if this bill goes through, I think I might apply for that job.
The only other thing I was going to raise is, I mentioned that example of Gucci purses. I mean, that's been a classic one of, you know, Gucci being ripped off. I suppose you could make an argument if someone uses someone else's logo on a bag or something, that there might be a trademark infringement, a different type of infringement. But the whole idea of copyright infringement implies that the actual function or you know, the nature of the fashion is what's actually going to be copyrighted as a price of the logo. So that whole argument about, like, Gucci purses and stuff, a lot of that maybe,
yeah.
Could that be dealt with in another way?
Yeah, so, you know, Julian talks a little bit about this, and I think what's really important to note, and your question brings it up perfectly, is that counterfeiting, right, taking somebody's Chanel or Gucci mark, copying that and using it is already unlawful, right? So you can't take people's protected marks. The trademark law makes that unlawful. You can you know, be penalized for that. You can go to jail. Okay, so that's illegal. Fabric designs, so original fabric designs, are already copyrighted. So you can't knock off somebody's copyrighted fabric design. What we're talking about here is something very different. What we're talking about here is the way a piece of clothing is cut, the way it fits your body, the way the sleeve looks, right, the way the neck looks, the way the hem looks. These things have never been subject to legal rights. Okay, they've never been the property of any particular designer. And what you see in the fashion industry, you know, common sense will tell you, go shopping and you'll see this. You see some basic themes being remixed over and over and over again. Now, you know, that's an equilibrium that has resulted in a lot of growth and innovation in this industry. And the one thing that I really worry about, bottom line, is before we go changing that, we really need to know more. The CFDA, which doesn't represent nearly all the fashion designers, it represents a few high-end fashion designers.
Could you define that acronym, who that is exactly?
The Council for Fashion Design of America. So these people don't, you know enough about copyright law, and they don't know enough about, you know, what the future holds if copyright law were applied in this industry, to my mind, to merit Congress changing the rules. Before we change the rules, we had better be darn careful, because we're talking about a lot of money here.
I do want to suggest that, bouncing off that, the language of piracy has been used very widely here. The act here is called the Design Piracy Prohibition Act, and that's, I think, as I say, I suggest in the article, is misleading in a couple ways. One is one that Chris covered pretty well, I think, which is that there's an enormous amount of conflation between counterfeiting, which is already illegal. You can't claim something as a Louis Vuitton purse if it isn't. That's just fraudulent. And these kinds of knockoffs. I mean, when they try to estimate the damage of knockoffs, you see things like quotations from figures from the Customs Bureau of the damage of counterfeit goods, which are already illegal and not what they're talking about. So there's that problem, and then there's the problem of assimilating this to the case of piracy in other areas where the dynamic is very different, right? Because I think this is really important. In music or film, when someone pirates a movie or a song, what's going on is that they're worried that you're going to get the copy instead of the original, because they're perfect substitutes, more or less, for each other, right? The copy DVD is exactly as good as the other DVD, and so the worry is people who would have bought the original are just gonna download the bootleg illegal copy, and that's just patently not what's going on here. If you listen to what the designers are worried about, what they're worried about is a kind of dilution, and that's why you can see even in these mastige lines that some of these designers are holding back. They don't want to do stuff for Target that looks too much like the stuff they're doing for the high end, because people who are paying $5,000. For a handbag or for a jacket, are in part buying the quality of the materials, the quality of the craft, but are also buying a kind of exclusivity, a kind of class semiotics. And I think it is important to question whether we want to protect in the same way the value of something that comes not from, just the intrinsic utility of it, but from the extent to which ordinary people are barred from having access to it. And as I suggest in the piece, this looks less like conventional copyrights in a lot of ways than it does like the Elizabethan sumptuary laws, which have analogs in ancient Rome as well, that defined the kind of clothing that a member of each particular class or rank was entitled to wear. And I think it's important to recognize the extent that this is different, whatever you think about
copyright in music or film from that in a way that has a lot of interesting and different implications.
And Tim, I just wanted to give you a chance to mention something you blogged about on the TLF this week, which was an interesting paper on the intellectual property and how it works in the magic industry that's gotten a lot of attention lately. And you drew some parallels between this and Professor Sprigman's work on the fashion industry issue. Could you tell us a little bit more about that briefly?
Sure. Well, it wasn't actually me that originally drew the parallel. The author of the paper is Jacob Loschen, who's a recent graduate of Yale Law School. This paper is an homage of Professor Sprigman's paper, and in the original, the fashion copyrights paper, he talked about what he called negative spaces in IP, which are these places where you have a lot of creative activity going on without any sort of copyright or patent issues. And so fashion is one example, cooking is another, and the magic industry is a third community. And the magic case is interesting because unlike most other industries, the value of the trick is the performances and the devices and so forth that they use in the magic industry is largely based on the fact that the public doesn't know how they work. And as a result, patent law, for example, is not a good fit for the magic industry because you have to disclose how a trick works in order to get a patent, and obviously the trick wouldn't be as popular anymore if the public could just go and look up the patent to figure out how it works. And so the Loschen paper goes into a fair amount of detail about how magicians go about both spreading ideas within the magic community and ensuring that the originators of ideas get proper credit, and also preventing outsiders from getting access to those same ideas. And there's an interesting combination of social pressures within the magic community. The most basic is just a rule that a magician never tells a non-magician how a trick works, and that's done by a variety of means. They control access to the magician journals. They control access to the magic shops. You can go into the magic shops, but you have to know somebody in order to get the really good stuff is under the counter, and you have to they have to verify that you're a magician before they'll give you access. And then there's also there's a strong norm within the community of magicians that when you use a trick with other magicians, you give proper credit to whoever originated it. And Loschen argues that these mechanisms are sufficient to accomplish some of the same things you would expect from a patent or trade secret regime without some of the lawyering overhead you'd get if you were applying the traditional patent or trade secrets in the industry.
I think this is a really good, strong paper, very interesting. And this is what Cal and I, Cal Rossiala, UCLA Law, who wrote this with me, who wrote the fashion paper with me, what we hope is going to happen here is that people will start thinking about all the different parts of what we call the negative space of IP. So as Tim, I think, correctly described, creative endeavors and industries that don't really depend on IP law as the tool that they use to incentivize creativity. So Loschen basically says, look at magic, right? You need to have some form of IP in magic, but the IP they have is not IP law. It's norms about attribution. It's norms about community is strong enough, this community is coherent enough, that these norms actually work better than intellectual property law would work, right? So this is a really nifty idea, and I think from the bit I've read on magic, it actually makes a lot of sense as a factual description of what's going on. And again, if people said, well, look, magic is a creative industry, we need to extend copyright to magic, my response would be, well, do it at your peril, right? Displace these norms at your peril. Same thing in fashion, right? Extend copyright to the fashion industry, displace the creative dynamic that already exists at your peril. Now, there's other areas we might want to look at. So food, right? When I was thinking about food for the first time as a IP issue, one thing I found that was really interesting is, thousands of years ago in the Greek city-state of Sybaris was the first IP system that we know about, and it was a weird one. It was an IP system that was focused on recipes. So if you had a really great recipe, you would go before a jury and you would prepare the recipe and they would taste it. And if they liked it, they'd give you a period of exclusivity on the recipe. You know, and now in our law, we get really no copyright on recipes because recipes are facts and descriptions of processes, neither of which are copyrightable. So there's very little copyright that applies to recipes, and yet we are drowning in cookbooks, right? So something's going on, right? Something's going on that gives us the recipes that we need. Something's going on that gives us the innovation in sports plays that we need, even though there's very little patenting activity, right? Something's going on in fireworks, in tattoos, in magic, in haircuts, in furniture. I mean, there's all these areas are areas where copyright and patent don't really apply very, very broadly, but there's lots of creativity.
Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Chris, Julian, and Tim for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. If you'd like to comment on something we said on the show, just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this specific episode. And if you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.